Welcome to Between the Lines. Listening to literature online. This is show number 44. The Solid Work of Ghost Writing, a conversation with James Buchanan. James has traveled with a friend via bus from Philadelphia to San Francisco, which led to a lifelong love for travel centered on work and experiencing the vibrancy and diversity of American culture. He's had numerous jobs, including tulip bulb harvesting, night snowmaking, sawyer, vineyard, and winery worker, construction cooking, and on and on. These life experiences, as well as the education he received from the two Quaker schools he attended, have served to inform his writing in unique and important ways. He majored in creative writing, then questioning the practicality of such a major, he changed it to political science. Before long, though, James began to yearn for something more and started writing for the local newspaper, which led to a career as a journalist and finally acting on his lifelong-held desire to write. His career was given a significant boost when he was asked by the MIT Press to ghostwrite a book on internet governance issues. He has since ghostwritten a number of books that explore the intersection of cutting-edge business concepts and technology for authors with large international audiences. His writing continues to receive high praise and includes a diversity of styles and subjects. This is your host, Monk. Thank you for listening. Welcome, James Buchanan, to Between the Lines. It's wonderful to have you on today. And how are things up in New Hampshire?
We're good. It's the sun's peeking out, the lilacs are in bloom, and it feels like spring is definitely here. So. Always a good thing for us.
Excellent. Lilac's one of my favorite smells on the planet. Or scents, I should say.
Yeah, no, it's good. They're good for sleep, so I guess it's a very relaxing thing.
Oh, okay. I'm really excited to have you on and talk to you because I guess, like most people, I know what the phrase ghost writing means, but I really don't know much at all about how it works. So, you know, I'm excited to ask you some questions and find out and learn about the whole process.
Sure.
I think, you know, we all, in a way, a writer kind of gets bits and pieces from, you know, something somebody said. It could be a friend or another writer. So, like, in some sort of cosmic way, we're all kind of ghost writing. You know, there's other people's ideas coming into it. But I guess first question would be sort of specifically, what is it that makes it ghostwriting, you know, in how much of it is you, your input, and how much of it is, you know, the person you're writing for?
Well, ghostwriting, you know, there's probably the narrow definition, which is where you essentially write a book for somebody else. And then there's sort of a broader definition, which is it can include, you know, sort of a more hands-on type of editing, or it can be writing coaching, uh-huh. or it can be, you know, working collaboratively with somebody on a manuscript and that kind of thing. And so I like to go with more of a broad definition because, you know, as much as I like to write, I also enjoy helping people kind of get better at becoming writers themselves and doing some writing coaching and help people understand the process of story development and structure and those kinds of things, which I think a lot of people overlook. But you know, so when I work with people, it can be a range of somebody already has a manuscript and they know it's got problems, and so they send it to me and we do, you know, a bunch of interviews, and then I work through it and kind of fix it up so it looks more like what they want it to look like. And then it can be somebody comes to me, and this happens a lot with business clients, mm-hmm. where they come to me and they say, look, I have this business methodology or process or idea that I use, and I want to write a book about it because I want to use the book to establish myself as what they call a thought leader, which means sort of a trusted advisor to people, somebody who's mm-hmm. very credible as an expert on this certain thing. And for these people, they, you know, either they don't kind of have the skills of a writer to be able to sit down and write a book, or they don't have the time, which is probably, you know, it's about 50-50 between people who say, I'm not good enough to do it on my own, or people who are like, I'm, you know, busy doing 20 other things and I want to produce this book, so, you know, can you do the writing for me? And so then what I'll do is we'll do initial interviews, and I just ask them, what are your goals for this book? You know, and I do memoir and you know, narrative nonfiction. And
right.
Too. And they'll tell me what they want to get out of the book, what they hope, you know, it'll do. And then I just say, you know, at a very high level, what do you think it's about? What do you think your story is? And we work through that. And I sort of start out broadly and try and narrow down to more kind of a better defined notion of what the story is that they want to tell, or what the topic is that they want to describe. So that I can then go and based on their interviews and then additional research, create kind of a section outline, and then we go over that and we create a chapter outline, and then we get into individual chapters, and, you know, depending on the book, you know, I'll section them out and, you know, kind of start sort of broad and work your way in. Mm-hmm. And the whole thing is always based on doing lots and lots of interviews, lots of conversations with the authors, and it's usually primarily their you know, material. It's their ideas, their thoughts, their concepts, and I'm just sort of putting words on a page to it. So I'm creating what I'm writing, but I'm creating based off their ideas.
Right. It sounds like it's almost like you're a combination of an actor. Because an actor, you know, sometimes will study a famous person and listen to them over and over and get their mannerisms. It sounds like, you know, your interviews, yeah. You get to know the person. And then it sounds like you're sort of a hardcore editor because, you know, you're kind of, you know, editing what maybe the person doesn't quite, you know, can put into their words because they're not used to writing.
Yeah. Yeah, and they just, a lot of times I find that people have, you know, the two big areas where people have the most trouble is just sort of like the work that you have to do before you start writing. It's the outlining,
right.
The initial sort of ideation and creation and that kind of thing. And then the second one is structure. And, you know, people really, really struggle with that. And so that's one of the areas that I'm pretty good at helping people figure out. If, you know, if they have a strong notion of what they want to do, or they already have some sort of a manuscript pulled together, I can help them get it organized and put it into a structure that works a lot better for them.
Yeah, I remember, like, I guess probably my first awareness of all this was as a young, in my teens, I was into sports, and probably the most books I read were sports books. And I, probably all of them, you know, were like so-and-so, like Walt Frazier with so-and-so.
Right.
Because, you know, you think, oh yeah, this guy's out, you know, working out, and who knows how much writing he's done. So most, you know, it makes sense that sports people would have somebody help them, I guess. So that's a distinction between, you know, books that say with a writer, because that happens a lot, and then when your name is just not on there, hence, you know, the ghostwriting title or untitled.
Yeah. I mean, both of those are considered ghostwriting. And,
okay.
I think it depends on the author and kind of the situation. I never advise my clients to try and get away with saying, you know, I wrote this without any help, you know,
right.
or I didn't hire a ghostwriter
mm-hmm.
because, you know, what you want to say is these are my ideas. I work collaboratively with someone and we produced this material together. But, you know, more often than not, just say I'm the author because,
mm-hmm.
you know, in reality they are. And so I tend not to want to be on the cover. Like I don't
right.
want to be with, you know, James Buchanan kind of thing because
right.
I really want the client to stand out and I want them to really, you know, fully realize and achieve kind of the goals that they have for the book. And I think sometimes if people know that it's ghostwritten up front, it almost takes away some of the legitimacy
mm-hmm.
of what they're trying to say. And so I want people to focus on the message of the book and not, you know, get into the sort of semantics of, you know, who did the actual writing, but whose ideas are they, and that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's a good, you know, technically and kind of humble approach to get out of the way and let the other person, you know, the person that its story is about, tell
yeah.
their story. Now, do they typically, you know, even thank you in the book, or are you kind of, you know, really invisible?
Yeah, usually, you know, it's in the back of the book where they have acknowledgement.
Okay.
And, you know, it's always funny. I did one book, and it was like 790 pages
Phew.
Long. And the author, you know, thanked, you know, his mother, his brother, his
mm-hmm.
best friends, his aunts and uncles, you know, everybody, and then had a list of names of people he thanked, and I was sort of buried in among that list of names. And I kind of chuckled, and I don't mind because, you know, it's his thing.
Mm-hmm.
But generally that's it. And
mm-hmm.
part of the agreement, though, that I have with everybody I work with is that I can use the final product to promote myself.
Right.
You know, I don't, you know, part of the contract is that I'm not going to go out and appear on TV and say, hey, I ghost wrote.
Right.
But I can use it on my website. You know, or if somebody's asking me what are some samples or examples of
mm-hmm.
things you've written, I can do that. You know, and use it that way.
Mm-hmm.
But otherwise, you're right. I try and be quiet about it. You know, and I do my own writing. I have my own. You know, I was a reporter for a long time. I've written a bunch of magazine features and short stories and essays. And so, you know, I've got my name out there. I kind of
right.
don't need that, you know, additional little ego boost or whatever it is.
Now, is that something? One of my questions is like, how do you maintain your author's voice? You know, because if you're, you know, you're writing your stuff and then you're
yeah.
helping somebody else, is it just like a simple change of hat thing? Because I know, like, I write poetry, essays, and it's just, I don't know how to explain it. It's just a different
yeah.
mode that comes on. So is it that way when you're
yeah.
doing different things?
Yeah, I mean, everybody has their sort of default writing
mm-hmm.
voice, I think.
Right.
And, you know, and I certainly have mine and sometimes struggle to kind of get away from it when I have to. But it, you know, it kind of depends on the book. Like, for a business book, they want to sound smart.
Mm-hmm.
So my default kind of, you know, I guess sort of smart guy kind of voice works for them because that's how they want to come across. Whereas, you know, for memoir, they want it to be a little bit more of their voice, and it needs to be a bit more in their voice. I have one client who, you know, had this, you know, just sort of horrific experience that had a profound effect on her life. And, you know, and she's a woman and she's experiencing everything as a woman. And so I really have to be very conscious of the fact that I'm, you know, writing from the perspective of a female. And so I don't want to sort of put on a female voice like a male actor would put
mm-hmm.
on a female voice. But I want to make sure that I use words that are consistent with her, the kinds of phrasings and you know, and everybody sort of has their own idiosyncratic way of speaking. But also make sure that I don't use words that might feel more like a male voice kind of speaking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which can be hard because, you know, women and men are kind of all over the place. But you really want to make sure that you don't have your voice kind of override the voice of the author.
I guess, yeah, it's kind of reminding me of a novelist or a playwright like Tennessee Williams. A lot of his plays, the, you know, main character is female. So, you know, a really good writer. Oh, yeah. A really good writer.
So that's gets a great example.
Yeah, you know, they get into the head of the person and you forget, you know, going, wow, this was written by a man, you know, so.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and that's it's an amazing example, actually, because I immediately think of Blanche DuBois.
Oh, yeah, one of my favorite.
You know, Streetcar Named Desire.
Yeah, that's one of my favorites.
And he captures her, you know, so well. And you know, it must have gone through draft after draft after draft. And so, you know, I try and do that, but not to an extreme. Like, you don't want to get caricaturish or,
right.
or kind of cartoonish. And that can be something that you got to watch out for.
Yeah, as a side note, I've watched that movie a bunch of times, even therapeutically. Like,
yeah.
Occasionally I've dealt, you know, with a female that just was, like, sort of out to lunch thing, and I was like, how did I get into that scene? And I'd watch that movie, and just, it was very, very therapeutic.
Oh, it's a great movie. I it's in my Netflix queue right now. I see it again.
All right. Yeah, I guess that, it's sort of like, I'm getting the sense that it's like your job is like editor, not, you know, playwright, actor. It's like a lot about sort of being objective enough that you're representing the person that you're working with.
Yeah, and it's also getting, you got to get really good at interview. And, you know, the business stuff, again, is pretty easy, though you want to dig a little bit deeper than sometimes what they'll give you just on the first pass. So that you can get a little bit into some more original material for what they want to present. But certainly with the memoir, because memoir is always about writing about tough experiences and
right.
very personal and very close. And people, their first instinct is to kind of protect their privacy. And that doesn't often make for good storytelling.
Right.
And so you've got to find a way to build trust with someone so that they know that whatever they say to you is going to be represented in a way that they feel good about. And also that you're not going to just, you know, sort of gratuitously throw some detail about their life in there that's going to make them or somebody they know upset. But at the same time, you got to get to those real nuggets that are hard to reach. And there's a book by Malcolm Gladwell called Blink, and basically he talks about, you know, sort of your first impulse is usually the correct impulse.
Interesting.
Right? You know, and he uses examples of people who tell the difference between a real painting and a forgery, and he has stories of people, their first impulse was to say, you know, I don't think this is a real painting or from the real, you know, painter. And usually that turns out to be right. And it's basically a process of your brain is just very good at making connections and noticing when things are a little bit off. But it's also your brain is kind of, if you spend too much time thinking about something and preparing for something, it makes it harder to kind of get more into your subconscious level with something and get deeper into your memory. And so I tell people not to really think too much before we do interviews. I'll say, here's what I'm going to talk to you about, you know, with your story. And then I want to engage them in a conversation so that they start to feel comfortable. And then they start to relax. And then they start to really forget that they're being interviewed and it's for a book and all that kind of stuff. And you can get somebody to a much, much deeper place in terms of what they're able to remember, but also the way that they're able to present it and talk about it. Then if you were to say, okay, I really want you to do a lot of thinking about this, and I'm going to ask you these five questions, and I want you to be prepared to give me answers to these five questions, you know. And I knew somebody, and he put this style of interview pretty well, and it's how I put it, is harvesting blanks. And you know, and it worked, when it works very well. You know, sometimes it can be hard to get to that space with somebody, but for the most part, you know, if you're, you know, a relatively, you know, sensitive kind of person, you know, people will trust you and they'll open up and want to share what they have to share.
I can tell you're a good interviewer because, like, what you're saying is stirring things. Like, I want to start talking about them, so I'm interviewing you, but, you know, anyway, it's really a back and forth. I'll be concise, because what you're saying reminds me of something that I was encouraged as a writer from with Ray Bradbury, because he described his writing process as just like getting an idea and just letting it go, and you just go at it, uh-huh. and you take sides, you know, for and against, and you just riff on things, and it is kind of like that. You don't think about it. You start writing, and it does, at some level, it taps into something, some subconscious or storehouse. So, you know, I think that is a very effective process. And similarly, with haiku, Basho, the master Basho, talked about writing haiku, and he said, like, it has to happen in an instant.
Yeah.
You know, like cutting a melon with a sword or something, where, again, you don't think about it because it can get too intellectual.
Yeah, yeah. So I think that's what Kerouac used to do, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think he wrote a lot of drafts. I think he sort of sat out and just tried to get his head into a certain space and just, you know, bang it out. Just let it flow and you know, very sort of like almost like a improvisational jazz player.
Right.
Just you get into the melody and the rhythm and then let yourself improvise off of that.
Yeah, I think for me, and I think a lot of people, though, there's typically a phase two, which is then the editing process takes more thinking and technical skill.
Yeah, that's where you got to have your, you know, sort of, your thinking cap on.
Right.
And, you know, sort of the unemotional, you know, being able to look at something and say, this doesn't work.
go ahead.
No, and just, you know, and I was just going to say, and be willing to kind of get rid of the stuff that, you know, you may think is really cool, but, you know, does it really take the reader where they need to go?
Yeah, that kind of leads into the question I have. Is, like, when people come to you with something, do they typically have a kind of manuscript or outline, or are they just sort of, my life is amazing, help me write it?
Yeah. Sometimes, you know, they just say, I have a good story.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'll say, okay, you know, what is your story? And they'll say, well, here's what happened to me, kind of thing. And always people come with some sort of preconceived notion of how they think it should be written.
Mm-hmm.
But rarely are they kind of so married to it that they're unwilling to hear what you have to say or suggestions that you want to make. And often, because they're not experienced writers or experienced with publishing world and that kind of thing, you need to make adjustments and kind of work through it with them. Which is another kind of skill that I bring, is that experience of having, you know, written books and then turned around and sold them to publishers and that kind of thing. And so I would always defer to an agent who is out in the business doing this, or a publisher who is out in the world doing the business of it. But I can help a writer get that much closer to where it needs to be. And then also, you know, provide them the sort of access and contact to various agents and publishers and that kind of thing.
Wow, so yeah, you really provide a lot of services for people. That's wonderful.
Yeah, I try to. I mean, I've been very lucky that I like the people who I've worked with quite a bit, and I've believed in the projects that, you know, we've worked on. I mean, some of them, not all of them, I guess, some of them have been kind of, you know, you believe in it, but it's not, you know, going to change your life or anything like that. But you want to help these people out. You know, you want to help them, you know, achieve this dream that they have of, you know, becoming a published author.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I'm going to put your link on the webpage. It's for your website. It's orchardwriting.com.
Yep.
O-R-C-H-A-R-D writing.com.
Yep.
Now I was looking over your bio, and it's interesting. Maybe you can kind of say a little bit about. It's like you've had a lot of different life experiences, jobs, you know, you list a whole bunch of jobs you had, bulb harvesting, snowmaking, vineyard, and then how that kind of melded with various, you know, odd jobs, life experiences, and how that led into writing and sort of focusing in on, you know, a quote career.
Yeah. Well, I always, I wanted to be a writer for a long time, since probably about seventh or eighth grade when I wrote something. That was pretty funny, and the teacher had me read it in front of the class, and everybody laughed at it. And so that felt pretty good. And, you know, kind of went from there and had a lot of respect for writers. You know, I thought there was something about people who could be that disciplined and that kind of thing. And so it was something that I really wanted to do. And I loved writers who could tell just really good stories. You know, I love The River Wye by David James Duncan, and I like a lot of John Irving, his books, though he can be, you know, obviously hit or miss, and those kinds of things, especially when I was a kid, I was really into those kinds of books. And it always seemed to me that to be able to write stories with that kind of imagination and depth, you have to have lived a life. Like, you can't live a sheltered, protected life where you're pretty much safe all the time and avoiding risk, and then think that you're going to go out and accurately capture what it means to take risk or what it means to live a life that isn't safe or sheltered, or you know, get into that kind of mindset, or know what it's like to be somebody who, you know, works a dangerous job, or whatever the character is. And I just think having a rich set of experiences is just a good thing to do for anybody. And then part of it too is graduating from high school and not exactly knowing what I wanted to do, and you know, trying a semester of college and realizing that, you know, I might graduate from college, but I wouldn't have a degree necessarily that I really believed in and wanted. And so I took that time to kind of travel around and you know, collect some experiences and you know, and work and find out what it was like to work. And you know, I enjoyed it, but then came to the point where it was time to go back to school and kind of get serious and did that, and then got out of college and pretty much got into journalism, which I really enjoyed because I was very interested in politics and social justice and grew up as a Quaker. And, you know, and that was a great experience and a lot of fun, but it never really paid very well, and it's hard to get into that sort of top tier where you're actually going to make a living. And I just started casting about for, okay, what's the next thing? And I happened to do some writing for a political candidate, creating a website and one thing and another, and a friend of hers who's one of the editors at the MIT Press called me up one day and said, hey, we've got this person who wants to write a book on internet governance, and would you, you know, help us out? And I said, sure, and had a great time, and it just one thing led to another, mm-hmm. kind of here I am.
Neat. Yeah, well, Walt Whitman's mom was a Quaker, so there's something good about that for helping the writing.
Oh, yeah, I'm very proud to be a Quaker. Good.
Has that affected your writing, or more the, sort of like the causes you might take up to work on?
I think it affects the writing because it gives you a sense of, you know, purpose and a sense of direction. And it certainly means that I'm not going to take on something just because the money's really good if I don't believe in it. You know, I mean, somebody could call up and say, I've got a business book, or I'm going to pay you this much money, and, you know, and I'll say, fine, I don't have an objection to it, and it, you know, doing this to make money. But if somebody were to come to me and say, I really want to publish something that conflicts with my views of social justice or my sense of ethics or morality or you know, I think is not going to help people or is going to hurt people or something like that, I'm pretty clear that I'm not going to do that.
Yeah, you probably would have turned down Hitler's Mein Kampf, right?
Yeah, it would have been a good paying gig, probably. But I wouldn't do that. And you know, and I think most people are that way, but, you know, being a Quaker just kind of a little bit more finer point or something like that.
Yeah, I can relate coming from that. I mean, one of my first books I did, it got me into the whole publishing and self-publishing, is called Singing an Epic of Peace. So it does, a lot of times when writing, just having that sort of angle or view, it'll shape what I'm about to say. So I can certainly see. I mean, that's pretty much with everyone, I would think. Interesting thing on your website, too, you said the author should also realize that ghostwriting is an iterative, I had to look up that word.
Oh, iterative, yeah.
Iterative process, and which I looked up, it said repetition.
Yeah.
So how does that, you know, how does that play into just like a work ethic?
Yeah, it's more of a sort of a series of events that follow each other, leading to an outcome, is how I sort of look at it from that point of view. And it's like I was describing earlier, you start with somebody and you say, you know, what do you want this book to do? And then what do you think your story is at a very high level? And you're constantly then refining and refining and refining until you get to that point where you have a fairly granular outline of what the book is going to do and what it's going to be. And the point for that, there's a lot of different reasons why I do that. One is it makes the writing a lot more efficient. But two, it helps you understand where you're going to go, which is pretty important when you're kind of writing for somebody else. And then the other is it makes sure that you're always on the same page with the author, which there's absolutely nothing worse in this world than sending off a chapter that you've worked incredibly hard on and interviewed all kinds of people and spent hours and hours and hours working over, and they say, you know, this isn't what I wanted at all. You kind of missed the point, and because you didn't take the time to really kind of work through it and communicate. So I have on my website what I call sort of the Ghostwriter's Framework, and it's all about laying out, here's how the process should work. And it's not that I'm dogmatic about it, that I have to do it this way every single time, but I want the people I work with to know that there's a reason behind why I do the things that I do. And it's all about not just getting the best book out of them, but making sure that we never hit a moment where they're frustrated with me because they don't feel like I know what they're asking of me, and I'm frustrated with them because I feel like I'm constantly trying to hit some moving target that you know, they have for me. And it just brings a lot of clarity and efficiency to the process.
Yeah, that's smart, because, you know, writers tend to have a kind of sensitivity because it's their own stuff, whether it's, you know, ego or not, or just protecting what they're writing. So, you know, when I work on projects with people, I kind of tell them similar thing ahead of time. It's like sometimes I'll just throw out a suggestion, you know, and I'm open to bouncing back and forth, but don't take it personally. Uh-huh. And just, you know, it just may be, oh, I don't like that line. And then a lot of times someone will come back with something and I don't have the answer, but it starts the process.
Yeah.
You know, and if they go along with it, it works fine. But if they're like, if they take it personally, like, oh, you don't like the line, then that's going to be trouble. So I try to tell them ahead of time, hey, you know, if I say I don't like something or I think it could be better, this is just part of the process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's important to not, you know, let your kind of, I don't know, protectiveness or ego kind of get too much in the way. Because there's going to come times where an author's going to go, I think this is okay, but it's, you need to work on this, you need to work on that. And first chapters are always like that, because you're trying to find the pace and the voice and all of these different elements for the book. And it's very, very hard to get it all right, you know, on that first time through. But then once you figure it out, you just get on a roll and off you go.
Right. How long is it typically, is there a typical time frame, like a year or 2 years of working with someone?
You know, it really depends on the book. Generally about 6 months.
Yeah, that's pretty quick, actually, think about it.
You know, but sometimes it's longer, sometimes it's less. You know, sometimes people are more available, sometimes they're less available. Sometimes you do lots of interviews, and it's hard to coordinate with the people you have to do the interviews with. So, you know, I mean, I've run into times where the author said, this person is really, really critical to get in the book, and I want them in the book. And then you go out and you kind of track them down, and they're like, well, yeah, I could do it in 6 weeks. So, you know, you're kind of stuck that you got to, you know, figure out what you're going to do for that 6 weeks.
Right.
You know, and it's just, it's, you know, it's part of the process. So.
Is there a typical theme, like of type of people? Like, is it sort of semi-famous people, or is it just people with interesting lives? Or, you know, you mentioned also like the business smarts. Is there categories of people you tend to work with?
You know, it'd be a lot of fun to work with. You know, I have some famous people in mind who I think it'd be a lot of fun to work with, but I've never really worked with anybody who I've thought of as famous. For the most part, it's, do they have a good story? Or, you know, on the business side, do I think that they're authentic? And do I think that what they're presenting is got real legitimate value, and you know, is going to help people, you know, be better at whatever it is that they're doing? And then I just, you know, I have to get along with the person. You have to like each other.
Right.
I had one guy, complete right-wing conservative kind of guy, and he approached me and he said, look, I want to do a book on taxes, but I don't want it to have a bias. I just want you to do original source research, interview people, and write a book about the federal tax code, you know, and how big it is, and that sort of thing. And he was up front. He said, I think the Republicans are too liberal. and that sort of thing. And so I thought, well, I guess if he wants, he's just looking for truth. He's go out, do the research, and write what you find. You know, I can do that. And so that's what I started to do. And of course, he didn't like what I found because it didn't match his preconceived, you know, right wing notion for how things worked. We parted ways pretty quickly. So sometimes that happens, but
yeah,
not
yeah.
too often.
Well, that's good. That's, you know, good that it doesn't happen too often.
Yeah.
That's, you know, you currently, because that's how you know, we met online, you're working on a book for more of a liberal politician. Can you
yep.
say a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's working on a book for, his name's Burke Cohen. He's, gosh, what was he, a 7-term New Hampshire state senator, and came of age in the 60s, was sort of born at the perfect time to be a teenager in the 60s. And he had a very kind of typical experience in a way that at the start of the 60s, he's just in his, you know, teens, early teenage years, and the family hops in the family station wagon and tours America. And they're not particularly liberal, they're not particularly conservative, they're just, you know, your sort of average middle-of-the-road kind of family. And that trip starts to kind of see some things that start to wake him up. And then he lives near Boston, and Vietnam starts up, and the civil rights movement is going on. And he starts to really think about these things more seriously. And at one point he hears Howard Zinn speak, and it is this revelatory sort of eye-opening experience for him that, you know, maybe the official line that he'd been being fed since, you know, entering school in the 50s isn't exactly the truth of America. And so he starts he starts to explore politics, but he also starts to explore the culture, and of course gets deeply into rock and roll time, and manages to go see the Beatles when they first come to the U.S. and you know, and has some pretty, you know, incredible experiences, and, you know, makes it to Woodstock, and goes to a lot of the protests, and, you know, and like everybody else, experiments, marijuana and LSD, and this whole notion of consciousness raising, and these other different things, and sort of comes out the other end and says there's a lot of things that were going on in the 60s that really have value, and they have lasting value. It's not the caricature that the right wing would portray it as, but it's also not the caricature that the left wing would portray it as either. So we need to kind of respect that, and we also need to really, you know, take a look at some of these things that came out of that decade, and really kind of not only just celebrate them, but realize that we need to do more. So you look at issues of nonviolence, you look at issues of civil rights, you look at issues of the environment, healthy foods such as organic farming and that kind of thing, women's rights, gay rights, you know, all of these kinds of things that are going on today, and people don't often, I think, recognize that if they didn't have their beginnings in the 1960s, they at least had some profound, you know, the 60s had some profound effect on these issues,
right,
in terms of making them more popular, making them more part of the common culture, and that kind of thing. And so it's an interesting, I like the idea of writing it from one person's perspective and experience, but telling a much larger generational kind of story.
Yeah, sort of like the part, you know, the part for the whole, what was I watching? Oh, there was a wonderful documentary I just watched, John Perkins, The Confessions of an Economic Hitman Guy.
Yeah, I've heard of that.
There's a documentary film called Apologies of an Economic Hitman, and I got that similar feeling while watching that, too, because he's telling this, you know, the story is about basically how global corporate empire and business, you know, works, and yet it's told through this very interesting, you know, individual story. So it has a sort of, you know, movie quality where it's, you know, one person, and that's an interesting technique, or just happens naturally.
No, I love that kind of stuff, and you know, I'm a big fan of Ken Burns.
And, oh yeah, the PBS.
He did the Civil War was kind of his first big one, but he's done, you know, baseball, jazz,
right.
You know, a whole bunch of them. And the reason why I think he does as well as he does is he tells big stories through the eyes of individuals.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, even with the Civil War, you see it through the eyes of the people who were experiencing it, because he was able to dig up, you know, so many letters and you know, writings and that kind of thing, that he could really get down to that kind of very close to the individual person.
That made
it really good, you know.
That's exactly what, I mean, I didn't read all of it, but Howard Zinn's People's History book, it's so many quotes and, you know, journals and things that are from the people, so that really is important.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, there's another writer, I knew I was going to forget his name, John McPhee. Oh. And one of the things that people always say about him is that he could write about paste and make it interesting, you know. And he just has this way of making anything interesting. And I think the reason why he's able to do that is because he turns everything into a human story.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and if you can do that, then I think, you know, if you can do that, I think you can even transcend the limitations of your own, you know, writing ability.
Oh, yeah, I got that lesson. I got my nephew, who's big into sports, a book, I think it's called My Caddy Was a Reindeer. It's some guy who played golf in the Arctic or something like that. And it's all these little vignettes. And so before I wrapped it up for his present, I started reading it. And I think the first section was about, it was something to do with Italian race car drivers.
Mm-hmm.
And it was something I would, you know, if you told me, I would be like, no thanks, I'm not interested. And there I am, like, you know, 10 or 20 pages into it, because he's talking about where they got the rubber for the tires from, and the material with the jerseys, and it was just all this. It was just so interesting. And after that, I was convinced, you know, virtually anything, a good writer, and make it interesting.
Yeah.
You know, for just like you're saying.
And it comes down to the research.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's how good are you at research, and more so than how good of a writer I think, you know, that you are, because if you do the research to really have a really interesting, compelling story, then it's you know, they sort of say it's going to write itself, but you don't have to do anything other than get out of the way of the story and
mm-hmm.
just tell it, you know. And I always think of, when I think of these kinds of books and issues, is that book Cod.
I'm not familiar with it.
It's a great, great book, and it just talks about the history of cod, which is, you know, the fish.
Oh, okay.
And it's a really, really well told story, and take something that you think, you know, how could you write an entire book about it, but why would an entire book be interesting on this thing? And just about everybody who's read it has finished it that I know, and really, really enjoyed it. And the person who wrote it, I can't remember the author's name, but gets down to that detail and tells the sort of the human story of this resource, this natural resource of cod.
Interesting. So, yeah, speaking of you know, the human individual, what on your website it shows that you write fiction and essays and mm-hmm. magazine articles, and mm-hmm. what are you working on now?
Well, I'm working on, you know, I'm always working on short stories. It's something that I like to do and wish I were better at. And I wish I could spend my all day writing short stories. that would be a nice thing for me to do. And I like personal essay. I've, you know, published a few. One of them was, it's in This I Believe on Fatherhood, which is the NPR show, This I Believe.
Okay.
I wrote something on my son, who's autistic, and it was nice to write about him, and it was very nice to see it get published like that. But another project that I'm working on, and I've actually just sort of started up with a fellow who's a documentary filmmaker, is on the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, which was the Americans who volunteered to fight in the Spanish Civil War in the mid-1930s.
Mm-hmm.
And they were literally the first Americans to fight against Hitler and Mussolini and fascism and Nazism. And they did that in Spain. And I did a bunch of interviews with a number of these surviving members. They're gone now. But two in particular really stood out to me, Abe Smoroden and Lou Gordon. And they were lifelong friends from high school. They formed together with a few other friends this group they called the Social Issues Club. And it was all dedicated to social justice. And they fought evictions during the Depression and were very, very well informed of what was going on in the world. And they knew about Hitler and fascism and the dangers that those posed. So when the Spanish Civil War started, they saw it as an opportunity to perhaps prevent, you know, the next big war and a chance to fight fascism. And so they volunteered and they went and they had incredible experiences. Obviously came back, you know, they didn't win that fight, but, you know, they continued with their lives, continued with their social activism. And Lou actually volunteered after Pearl Harbor to join the U.S. Military. And interestingly, before, at this time, they were getting some of these vets from the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. So they came home and continued with their social activism and their lives and were kind of harassed by the government because they were seen as, you know, untrustworthy and that kind of thing. And then after Pearl Harbor, Lou Gordon volunteered to join the U.S. Army. And at that point, there were quite a few of the brigade members who were thinking of joining the military. However, they were all listed, and this just blows me away, but they were listed as premature anti-fascists.
I'd have to think about that. Premature anti-fascists. Okay.
Because they came out against fascism before the government, you know, said it was okay to be against fascism. It's kind of
that's like a fascist. It's almost like a fascist statement. Like you can't do anything until we tell you. You can't be free until we tell you you can be free.
Right. Like you could be a premature anti-racist. You know,
oh my gosh.
Thing. And. But so a lot of them get turned down, but somehow he made it in. And so he fought from the D-Day landings in Europe through to the German surrender and was part of the group of soldiers that liberated the Dachau concentration camp. And so he literally fought from the very, very first battles of World War II in Spain to the, you know, the very last battles in Europe. And one of the interesting things he said to me is when he was at Dachau, you know, they knew back, you know, in 34, 35 that these concentration camps were starting to exist. And one of the things that they were trying to prevent was not only World War II, but, you know, what they felt was going to happen to the Jews and others. And so in an odd sort of way, being at Dachau proved that, you know, he was right. And it was sort of a very interesting feeling for him to have had that experience, but not to have been able to prevent it, but here, you know, he was right, and the people who he was with, who believed in social justice and believed in having their eyes open and being aware, knew what they were talking about.
That sounds fascinating.
So it's really interesting guys. They lived the kind of lives that I don't think you can live anymore. You know, very, very interesting, you know, active and engaged with the world and just kind of going from one experience to the next.
I'll throw in my little tidbit of in indigenous history that the some of the, not the inspiration, but the idea for the concentration camps came from the you know, the reservation system already going on in the U.S. A lot of people don't realize that.
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me.
Yeah. Anyway, let's see. Well, as I kind of wrapping up here. So, yeah, I've really got a whole, you know, lot of, much more understanding now of what the ghostwriting, like, behind it is because, you know, you're really like a storyteller, an actor, interviewer, editor. There's a lot going on there that's... That's wonderful to learn about. What would you, kind of like a wrap-up question here, as far as encouraging other writers, you know, would you say anything to younger writers or anybody at some point, do you think there's a difference between, say, maybe it's just an innate, you already know, but like a writer choosing to be like, you know, I'm going to be a writer, I want to write this novel, or I'm going to be a writer, I want to help other people write, you know, do you think there's anything, you know, anything advice that to help people know, like, because I would never, I probably hadn't, would have thought of, oh, wait a second, you know, because now I'm thinking, well, maybe not necessarily ghostwriting, but it's just opening up my sense of what I might be able to do to help other people with their writing. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, I mean, my first thing is, you know, journalism, working in newspaper is like writer's boot camp, because you have to produce publishable stories every single day, and usually you have to produce two or three of them, and you've got an editor hovering over your shoulder who will tear you down in front of everybody in the newsroom if you screw up. And if you screw up and it gets into print, you've got the entire readership who are going to let you know about it. So you learn very, very quickly how to do the, you know, good research, solid research, and kind of vet out what's important and what isn't important. And then the second thing I would suggest to anybody who really wants to get a better understanding of what it takes to write a good story is there's a book that's kind of become my Bible, mm-hmm. and it's called Storycraft,
Interesting.
A complete guide to writing narrative nonfiction, and it's by a guy named Jack Hart, and he was an editor at the Oregonian, and he's not somebody who you naturally would have heard of, and I don't think he's edited big books that everybody's read, but he understands writing in a really detailed and way, and is very, very good at describing it and teaching it. And it's a great book, especially the chapter where he talks about structure.
Good. Thanks for mentioning that. I'm gonna, you know, look it up. I'll try to put that book up on the link on the page too.
Okay.
So, anything else you want to add? We covered a lot of stuff.
Yeah. No, I think that does it. Just, you know, right. Other than, you know, people write. I love what I do, and so if you want to do it, just get started.
Yeah, it's very, and also you're, when I first looked at your website, it's very endearing because you're in your bio, you had, at the beginning you mentioned, you know, your two kids, wonderful names, Quincy and Violet.
Yep.
And you have your son Quincy would also be upset if he were to forget their leopard gecko Spotty. So, you know, sometimes people try to be too cute on their stuff, but that, to me, that was like really, wait, this guy's got a sense of humor. He's not just like, you know, my first book was published in 19 whatever, and you know, some people just list everything, and it's too dry for me.
Yeah, it's sometimes you can get with other writers, and everybody's trying to one up the other. I'm more interested in learning what they know that I don't know. So.
All right, great. Thanks so much, James. And for people that want to, you know, connect with you, it's orchardwriting.com, and like to go out with a little music for each show, and I looked up online and found, I haven't seen this film, I had heard about it, called Ghost Rider. It's a short little theme piece of music. Have you seen the film?
Heard of it, Ewan McGregor, and from what I've heard, his life is far more exciting than mine.
Well, that makes sense for a movie, I guess.
Yeah.
So, all right, thanks so much, and, you know, good luck in with all your projects.
All righty, well, thank you.
Thanks, James.
You.